Okay, gang, let's go ahead and get started. How are you guys doing? Everybody okay? Good? Yeah. Hanging in there?
Yeah.
So as you know, I mean, this is the approach we're taking toward the end of the semester is to kind of taper off our readings. We have a short chapter to talk about today. So there isn't like a big grand finale. I'll make some comments at the end of next week, but mostly I want to get out of the way to make room for you to be doing your papers. I've been talking to a lot of you about your papers. We brought it up in class last time. I want to leave some time now to talk about it. Some of you didn't make it last time, but I do want to kind of remind you, whether you were here or not, of kind of this rubric. And a little bit of a grade norming strategy. So grade norming, when faculty get together to grade, like, essays for a prize or, you know, senior theses or check learning outcomes, we often get together and we kind of grade norm. So what we try to do is get the same picture in our heads about what we're looking for, right? And so we talked last time about flow as our writing area. Content is how you integrate information and research. Logic has to do with, of course, the structure of the argument. And insight was our slightly ineffable category. And you remember, I told you you're going to have a 1 to 7 point scale. And last time I said, look, you know, one way to approach this to get some consistency is to just assume that when you pick up the paper, you're looking at fives. You know, like start it with that as your baseline. And this could be, somebody was asking about this, and I was hedging a little bit. This could be some kind of a B. We don't know yet, because we don't know what the distribution's going to be like and what it looks like and what the low-end paper looks like in terms of absolute grade. But in terms of grade norming, and then I thought after last class, I thought to say, look, I never really give less than a 4 on insight. That's just kind of like my practice. And I wanted to be real transparent with you. I mean, I don't give 1s and 2s. I mean, you know, so I want to kind of get us normed on how we're using this scale, right? Because you might be thinking, well, the worst paper I should give 1s to, and not quite. You know, it's more like, let's say that on average we're looking at something between 16 and 28 points. What if that's like our active grade range? You see what I mean? Because that kind of matches, that would be kind of match my commitment to you all semester that we try to get everybody somewhere between a B minus and an A, right? That's kind of like a friendly grading distribution because it kind of gives you plenty of information about how you're doing relative to the group. But it doesn't brutalize you by giving you like C's and D's and F's. I know those need to be there in the case of, you know, total failure, the wheels come off. I mean, there are situations where you might, but to get 1s and 2s, you'd have to be writing a paper that I doubt anybody's gonna write. You know what I mean? It would have to be like so below standard. So does that help a little bit? That we're kind of really talking about somewhere between 4s and 7s, or 16 to 28. And, you know, I will give 3s sometimes in these categories. I tend not to an insight. Oh, does that help a little bit? Last time I lined up, if there's a kind of litmus test, I would say, like things, a checklist that I'm going through, that I'd like you also to use as peer graders, I would say it's topic scope. I wrote this last time. I put it all under logic last time, but I think that was a little bit confusing. All 4 of these categories bear on these. Thesis statement. Basis. Extent. Capital letters. And then awareness of diverse viewpoints. You always want to keep in mind who in your audience. You know, one of the things I'm excited about with this kind of pedagogy is that your audience for the paper is at least 5 people. In a traditional model, it's exactly 1 person, right? I'm your audience. So as you're writing your paper, be aware that we want you to develop skills. You know, you want to develop skills as an ethical thinker and someone who's articulate about your values. You want to develop skills for taking into account the range of viewpoints out there, to know that when you articulate your views with others, you want to kind of account for that. Okay. All right, so this is something that I guess I would use a checklist. Your writing ability, your research abilities, your ability to integrate information, your ability to put together a sound argument, and even to reveal insights about the topic, those all come through in these.
So as peer evaluators, I'd like you to keep those five things in mind as well, along with the rubric.
Okay, any other thoughts about this? One thing I'm going to prompt you for, and I'll tell you now, I didn't quite get it ready in time for class, is I'm going to suggest that you, in writing your paper and in evaluating other people's papers, I'm going to suggest that you go back to position paper one, that link you have to the directory, right, and you have all the grades, and I'd like you, I'm just going to suggest that you read, you just browse a couple of the papers that got top scores. I mean, that's writing that got scored that way. So, you see what I mean? So, and maybe look at some in the middle of the pack, you know, and that's not a bad thing to do before you read and evaluate the four papers that you're supposed to score as well. Okay? So, I'm very excited about this.
I have a question that's, like, not specifically about this paper, but, so I know that we have papers for our, like, final.
Oh, good, right, yeah,
so
let's talk about that, sure.
Does that mean we're going to meet in class at some point?
Yeah, let me be real clear about that. So, the dates are relevant to, we will not meet the week of the 8th, exam week. I will, by about the 4th or the 5th, I will send out essay questions that I'm going to ask you to write two-page essays on. One question I'll probably stipulate, and the other question you can choose from a list. And then we need to negotiate this, but I'd like you all to be able to turn those in potentially by Tuesday or Wednesday of exam week. But maybe you guys don't have your exam schedules in your heads yet. I don't know. Does that sound plausible, though? Sometime in the middle of exam week, I could get these essays. I think I've told you I'm headed off to my son's college graduation. Yeah. But I can take your grading with me. I just have to have it with me.
So are we not going
to
be grading?
Okay.
We
can get in by the
final day. Yeah, we're going to... Technically, that would be the negotiating point, is that we have this official final exam time, right?
It's like 8 p.m. on Friday,
isn't it? Is it really?
It's
holy cow.
Really crappy time.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to meet. It's open book, open note, internet. As I said, you're welcome to talk to each other about the essays. Just park company when it's time to draft your answers. That usually works pretty well. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. Other questions? Good? Yeah.
Do you have a preference between Tuesday and Wednesday?
Of exam week, either of those days would work for me. So when it comes down to it, if you guys are okay with the middle of exam week then let's do it. I mean, it's not a huge amount, but it's two more opportunities for you to practice your skills. Okay, maybe you could lower your lids a little bit. You guys are kind of, maybe you have some notes to take, that's fine, but let's kind of keep our attention together a little bit. I'd like us to get into the chapter, I have a group exercise that I'd like you to do. And we did this in a very leisurely way in the first class, and I think we wound up with 10 or 15 minutes to spare. So I don't think there's any you know, time pressure on this. Like I said, we're kind of tapering here at the end of the semester. Some cool research, though, so let's get into it. And again, don't let me inhibit you from taking notes on your laptop here. Just kind of look at each other, too. Okay, so let's talk about this. Let's set this in context first. Remember, the slogan for this third part of the book is that morality binds and blinds, right? So last time we looked at his case for multi-level selection. Let's just remind us that this tie chapter 9 in here. So the idea is that if maybe this is a good note for you to have to kind of connect the last class with this class. Multi-level selection theory, MLS, you have this in your notes from last time, but you know, MLS is, if it's true, it's part of a mechanism that binds us into groups, right? Because if multi-level selection theory is true, then there are selection pressures on us as groups, right? Does that make sense? Can we get the nonverbal going? Okay. So that's the binds part, right? And remember, we said that we were going to learn about the blinds part in the next chapters. And so now the hive switch, so now this is line this up with chapter 9. If there is a hive switch, it's another way that we are bound together in groups. So the idea that groups compete in evolutionary terms is the idea behind chapter 9. The idea that evolution has given us mechanisms to flip something called a hive switch, metaphorically, is the idea in chapter 10, right? So let's look at the evidence for the hive switch. It's part of morality binds. Now, another point for your notes. The hive switch blinds you, too, because when you flip the hive switch, critical thinking goes down. This is really important. This is going to be important to our critical assessment. So morality binds and blinds. Chapter 9 didn't tell us anything about the blinding, as I recall, but this one tells us of another mechanism for the binding and something about the blinding. Okay, are you with me? Good. All right, so let's take a look at the hive switch evidence. One of the best places to look for the hive switch is in physically bonding activity, muscular bonding. Okay, I have some correlates from you guys. I know we have Emily here who's been rowing, right?
Yeah.
Right, this is, I was using you as an example last class. We had a dance student in the last class. Do we have any dance students in this class? Or people who've done dance? Yeah, not you. Okay. What's your experience of this? What is the moment at which, maybe it's rowing, maybe it's something else, maybe it's not dance. Can some of you try to describe this moment when you're in physical unity with people? Yeah.
Well, I also rowed. I rowed
Good.
For
oh, cool.
like 8 years.
Neat. Wow.
And I actually read a book called Boys in the Boat that was describing this also as a hive thing.
Yeah, good. Sure.
The book.
Good.
And it's very true. Like, my senior year, I was only rowing in, like, one boat because it was a pretty clear, like, top boat.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the season, I had this issue where I would lose my vision when I rowed really hard. And
interesting. Wow. Oh, wow. That's scary.
My body just automatically knew what the rest of my boat was
right.
doing, so I didn't
right.
have to even, like, see them or hear
yeah.
them. I just knew exactly what was happening.
You're reminding me also that musicians might, I hadn't thought about this, but right, if you've played in orchestras or symphonies, do you also have this
mm-hmm.
kind of synchronicity? So muscular bonding is one aspect of it, but just being in sync, right? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I played in an orchestra for a long time, and you sway a lot when you stand, and
Interesting.
You'll sway
right.
the same rhythm.
Right. Yeah, good. Other examples? Yeah, good. That's a great example. Emily, have you experienced this?
Yeah, there's sometimes when sometimes the work is pretty hard, so you just don't want to think a lot either. It's,
mm-hmm.
That's what makes it a little easier sometimes, is not thinking as much and just
right.
dealing with everyone.
Right. Any golfers in the room? I mean, golf is one of those sports where it's an individual sport, right? But not thinking is part of accessing the right movement, right? So getting to be in sync, it's a good point for your notes. Already getting in sync with people involves suppressing reflection, right? If you start to be too aware of your body, like think about when you've been dancing, if you're too self-conscious about your body, you don't enjoy dancing, do you? I mean, as much, right? So there's a kind of flow or automatic feeling to this. Last class we talked about the serpentine that you guys did as freshmen. We had some negative. We did. Are you guys want to dump on the serpentine? You can.
I just think everyone got sick afterwards.
Yeah, it's a lot of germs. Yeah, the hive switch is a germy thing. Yeah. Did it work for you? No, you didn't like it. I think it might need to be renewed. I hope you guys communicate this to your orientation teams, because years ago, Gonzaga students would spontaneously talk about how cool it was. And it could be that these things have a cultural reality to them. It could be that the serpentine is kind of like eating goldfish or something, like a college stunt, you know.
I just think they built it up too much, and then you just have to run.
That's what somebody said. It was a little bit overhyped. Yeah, yeah. Can you think of something else you would do? Yeah.
I was just saying that I'm an RA, and we always are brought in to be the safety people, and it's always so annoying because I'm like, why is this even needed?
I know.
It's like we're needed to like watch out for students
who are going to get hurt in doing the serpentine
yeah.
exercise.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Serpentine.
Yeah, but do you see the need for it? Do you see what we're trying to do? I mean, it's a residential campus. I didn't go to a residential campus. I was at an urban campus. Nobody was interested in orientation at all. You know, we weren't a group. So there's a part of this, part of the Gonzaga experience really does seem to have to do with a bonding experience.
Like when we're at games and we all jump in.
Absolutely, good. That, let's get that in our notes. Muscular bonding is something that you guys are probably less critical of when it comes to sport watching. And the kind of, yeah, that's you. How does that feel? It's a kind of, Durkheim used this phrase, collective effervescence. It's like you're in a group of people and it feels like something's bubbling up. Is that kind of interesting kind of metaphor for it? Any other words for that? Now, here's a critical question. So you know from your chapter that when Europeans started going out and discovering non-Europeans, they found people who were very emotional. They would paint their faces, paint their bodies, engage in dance, engage in ritual that seemed pretty emotionally intense to a staid and stuffy European. And the judgment was, wow, these are savages. We don't do this anymore. Good for us. So European culture did move toward a less traditional model and less celebratory, less sociocentric. This is something that's going to come up in your group work, I hope. Did we go wrong? That's clearly we clearly think that's a, these days we wouldn't make that judgment. But we would say, oh, there's a cultural difference. In those cultures, people dance. In Italian culture, you go to community festivals. There's intergenerational dancing, something Americans would never count as. Oh my God, you're going to dance with babies and old people? You guys would probably be okay with dancing with babies. But, you know, Italians are comfortable. Of course, they go to concerts, you know, so there's age segregation. There's concerts that, you know, people your age would only go to, just like you go to Sasquatch or Coachella. But there's also a kind of openness. This is the point maybe for your notes. Traditional societies are more open to hive behaviors. Small towns are still more open to hive behaviors. Oh, I meant to mention this in the other class. Wow, I'm glad I thought of it. Did anybody catch the news about the town in Oregon that didn't want the community college? Did you hear that? The town in Oregon that it's a little bit of a digression. It won't take that long. So there's a town in Oregon that declined getting a community college, which would seem like a really... And a friend of mine said, oh, isn't that stupid? She said it that way, too. And I've just been thinking about the moral foundations. I should also tell you in the news story, they declined it because a town near them, also a small town, accepted a community college branch, and then they got a refugee center. And they were not happy about that. And that's because the hive, right, the group, right? This also goes back to moral foundations. The group saw that as a threat to their unity. Like, well, we don't want that to happen to us. So you could say, well, they're stupid, they're ignorant, they're racist, they're xenophobic. Fine. But you could also say that they feel a threat to their unity. They feel a threat to the group. So the hive mentality is something that probably helps us compete as groups. But notice the blind part, right? We can work against our self-interest if we promote our group unity at the expense, say, of getting higher education in our town. Okay, anyway, sorry, that was a bit of a digression. We're making a list here. So, sources of the hive switch, muscular bonding, celebration and dance, all in nature, right? One way that we trigger the hive switch is by feeling connected. How many of you have this experience? Hiking, being out in nature, camping. Feeling connected to things. You have this wonderful quote from Emerson, the transparent eyeball experience. It's really powerful. And the idea is that when you feel, tell me if this fits your experience of awe in nature. If you felt awe in nature, did you feel a suppression of your ego? Did you feel like you kind of disappeared? Maybe not. I don't know. I think that happens. You feel your significance? You ever stared at like a really beautiful night sky with stars, right? Okay, keep the list going. Entheogens, something we don't usually talk about that much in education. We don't want to get you thinking about this, but chemical substances that lead us to have experiences of the divine, experiences in which we immerse our ego in a group. Most religions have histories of entheogens. A simple example for you guys would just be when you go to a party, if you have a glass of wine, you're reducing your resistance to other people, is that right? People start to look a little friendlier, you start to feel a little friendlier, right? So the hive switch can be flipped. Yeah, I know you're thinking about times when you really flip the switch. I know, I'm not talking about those times. Okay. It went beyond the hive. You know, so, but just think in a very mundane way. When you're in groups, I want you to be thinking about where the hive switch comes up. Maybe it came up when you went to Sasquatch one time, or, you know, but, and it comes up at raves, right? So modern examples of entheogens are substances that that give us access to the hive, really. That can be communion. It can be a religious communion, right? Literally, a communion is an attempt to kind of be together. Okay. Big area for the hive switch. Oh, my God. Oxytocin. How many of you have read about oxytocin in other classes? A little bit? No? Yeah. Okay. Comes up in psych. Comes up in biology, right? Really cool chemical, I think it's a hormone, right? And you got a little background on oxytocin there, right? By the way, oh, I didn't mention, I went to see Franz de Waal last night. Were any of you there? It was so exciting. It was packed. The Fox Theater was packed. He spoke for over an hour, and he was a really good presenter. He presented some of the research we read in the Tanner lectures, and he presented some more recent stuff. One of which bears on this, which is that he said that all mammal studies seem to show that empathetic behaviors are more frequent in among females of the species. So empathy, he said very directly, empathy is a sex-linked characteristic. Fair enough. I think I believe that. On the other hand, I have colleagues in women's studies who would say, no, that can't be true. There are no sex-linked attributes like that. Those are all products of patriarchy. So interesting that he was so direct about it. He was like, no, this is it. Anyway, interesting stuff. A lot of interesting research, some of which bears on some of our research topics. Really cool research. Gosh, I wish I had a tape of it. Anyway, back to oxytocin. So we've known about oxytocin for a while, but only recently have there been some really cool studies about it. And you got the Dutch, we'll talk about the study with Dutch men, but I want to digress to talk about a book that wasn't mentioned in there. Paul Zak is an oxytocin researcher who wrote a book with the crazy title, The Love Molecule. I just want to tell you how the book opens, just to give you an image of how oxytocin might work in social groups. So in this country, you can't do experiments with oxytocin using a nasal spray. With the Dutch men experiment, you notice they'd use this nasal spray that has oxytocin in it. So Zach is an American researcher, and so he's had to go to Europe to do some of his studies because that turns out to be a good way to deliver the chemical in an experimental setting. Anyway, he had done some research, and his science journalist contacted him, and she was getting married in the UK, and she said, "Hey, why don't you come out and do an oxytocin study at the wedding?" And this is what science nerds really think about doing when they get married, right? Like, let's do an oxytocin study, right? So here's what they did. It's really cool. It's the way the book opens. So he brought a bunch of equipment. They rented a centrifuge. You've got to take blood from people, you know, quickly because oxytocin disperses after about 15, 20 minutes. So if you hug someone, you give them a little squirt of oxytocin, you get a little squirt too. Isn't that wonderful? So at this wedding, what they did was they took the wedding party and they marched them through a little tent and they drew blood. And then they all did the wedding. And then they had to go back through the tent right away and they drew blood. And so here's what they found out. It's really cool. The oxytocin levels were directly proportional to intimacy to the couple. So whether you were family or friend, it was about how close you were to them. Isn't that interesting? So the point for your notes would be that oxytocin might be part of a system that actually discriminates among people that we have hive-like relationships with. Because it purports, see what I mean? I'm not expressing myself well. it suggests that oxytocin is a part of a dynamic and discriminatory system that we use to bond differentially to some people. The person you most want in your wedding party is probably going to get the biggest oxytocin rush out of you getting married, next to you and your partner.
Was it the perceived closeness of the person? Good
question.
I don't know how they assess that.
If there was like one person who was like, they're my best friend.
Yeah. And it's like, sorry, I didn't really see a whole lot of oxytocin there. Yeah, I know. That would be awkward.
Yeah.
I don't know how they determine that. They might use a peer method. It might be more reliable to say, to have everybody evaluate who's closest. Just like, yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, it's a good book for your summer reading list. You know, sitting around the pool with the Love Molecule book, you never know what might happen. Okay, so with the Dutch men, though, and here's, let's get back to the main path. So we're making this list of ways to flip the hive switch, and then we're going to raise a critical question about it. With the Dutch men, notice what we found out here, if we could just follow this together a bit. I didn't get the details in here. All right, so in one set of studies, Dutch men played, it's hard to just imagine Dutch men doing this, but they played a variety of economic games while sitting alone in cubicles linked via computers into small teams. Half the men had been given a nasal spray of oxytocin and half got a placebo spray. The men who received the oxytocin made less selfish decisions. They cared more about helping their group, but they showed no concern at all for improving the outcomes of men in other groups. In one of these studies, oxytocin made men more willing to hurt other teams. So here's the point for your notes. Oxytocin stimulates group bonding. It doesn't always stimulate out-group hostility. So I'll say it again. Oxytocin always stimulates group bonding. It doesn't always stimulate out-group hostility. So group bonding would be in-group bonding, right? And so it doesn't always, but it does sometimes. So morality binds us and blinds us, right? The forces that lead us to be moral and moral groups, cooperating groups, also lead us to think negatively of out people that are not part of our group. But oxytocin isn't always directly related to out group hostility. That's the point. So anyway, but there is this relationship, there is a general relationship between building in-group harmony and getting out-group, negative views of out-group. So when you go to assess the hive switch, is it something that we should promote more? Is it a bad thing that we don't have as many communal experiences that flip it? That's kind of one of the considerations. Okay, on your list, mirror neurons goes on the list, right? Mirror neurons are another source of evidence of how the hive switch gets flipped. And these were discovered accidentally in an Italian neuroscience lab where they had this monkey, I think it was, hooked up to electrodes, right? So they were monitoring the monkey's brain systems, and it was between experiments, and the researcher was the guy, Gazzaniga was the guy. He was over at a table, like, eating a sandwich, and the electrodes were still hooked up, and they registered mirror activity in the monkey in their motor cortex area. So the point for your notes is that mirror neurons seem to connect mammals, I think it's only mammals, so that they spontaneously share experiences. That's kind of cool. Now, early on, we thought it was motor cortical mirroring, like that. So you saw me eat the sandwich and you had some connection in your brain to sandwich eating. But now that, I guess, the research is tilting toward thinking that it's really what you mirror is goal-directed activity. So so mirror neurons are more evidence of how we have shared intentionality. Remember we ran across that last class? So the hive switch is part of what the hive switch means is the ability to share goals and intentions, to mind read. Remember we used this phrase, mind reading? I mean, part of what we do with our big brains is we're really good at reading each other's minds. And that's one of the ways that we experience the hive, is that we share a lot of we share a lot in terms of our intentional space. We can, okay. Then a couple small details, and then I'd like to get you into discussion about this. So some of you might be interested in thinking about how the hive switch plays out in organizational life, right? So you have this contrast between transactional leadership, where the transactional leader is primarily motivating people by motivating them to pursue their self-interest. Let's get that in your notes, right? The transactional leader is stimulating self-interest as a means of moving people. The transformational leader, I'm told from other research as well, is trying to motivate people by getting them to bond together in a group. And mission-centered organizations are really good at doing this, because if you're, you know, if you work at Gonzaga, especially as long as I have, there's happiness research that supports this as well, that you get there's a kind of satisfaction from being able to participate in an organization by sharing a vision of the mission of the organization. And there's research that suggests that people who feel connected to their work at the level of mission, shared mission, get satisfactions from their work that people who just work for pay don't get. Right? So that's something to think about as you go forward. How important is it to you to be part of an organization that you feel connected to versus just to be part of an organization that you feel properly rewarded by, right? There's a discussion about fascism and hives. I want to leave that out this time around, and I want to kind of get you into groups. So here's what I'm going to suggest you do for your prompt. I'd like you to get into groups and really kind of share some examples from your experience, or, you know, if they involve things you don't want to disclose, you can always say, well, I have a friend who just goes to raves a lot, you know, and you know, so you can always put it in the third person if you've got it, kind of protect your privacy. Share some of the examples from your experience, mundane and not so mundane examples of the hive switch, and then try to figure out whether the dangers of the hive switch, loss of critical distance, over-trusting, groupthink, are the dangers of the hive switch offset by the benefits? And this is the question I raised at the beginning. Should we look at traditional societies and say, wow, we kind of went wrong. We should have kept something like that. We should have kept communal dancing. We should have kept communal food practices. We should have... I'll give you some other examples when you come back from your group. So the critical question for your groups is the hive switch a vestige of an earlier part of our evolution that we should move away from because it blinds us? Or should we get the benefits of the hive switch and mitigate the negative side of it? Is it, you see what I mean? So let's get into small groups, try to do that, 7 to 8, 10 minutes, see how the discussion goes, and try to bring back some answers, and I'll try to work on this as well. Okay. Feel free to get up and take a break if you need to and all that. It's okay.
Yeah, after training, like that. to learn more about each other's working styles. So
we
can
learn
more about each
other's
like small town, like everybody is at a certain political party, and like
I actually
Okay, guys, maybe we could get together again. Okay, gang, let's compare some notes across groups if we can. Okay, let's flip the hive switch if we can. Okay. Good. Sounds like some vigorous discussion. This is great. Sorry to interrupt it. I just thought we'd kind of see if we can pull together stuff that came out of your discussions and maybe develop this a little bit. Our goal is kind of move toward a kind of critical assessment of this these mechanisms and see how we should be using them, what their value is. So what about in your experience? Did you come up with more data points for how how the hive emerges in your experience. I mean, for many of you, it would happen in religious worship, right? I mean, that would be one place that you could feel this connection. Do you feel that suppression of individuality, suppression of the ego? Other cases, other places?
Well, I live in a house of, like, 7 people.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of, when you, like, first start living together, it's kind of hard. But then over a period of time, like, everyone wants, like, certain places, like, kitchen cleans. Everyone kind of, like, just tries to work together.
Yeah. You
kind
of form a group if it goes well. You have other stories about houses where, you know, things kind of fracture. So, yeah, you can relate it to that, absolutely.
Going off of that,
yeah.
I have a pretty big family on my mom's side.
Right.
And so there's, like, 120 of us in 3
wow.
generations.
Wow, wow, good
and
for
all,
you.
And we all, like, in August, we have a week where we go
yeah.
to Oregon Coast and spend time with each other.
Yeah.
And so having that many people together,
that's very cool.
You kind of, it's not even a bad way, but you kind of have, like, a loss of, like, your own self.
Yeah.
And, like, you
yeah.
have to be, like, feeding everyone. You have to be so focused on, like,
right.
the good of the group. And, like, I just remember being little and, like, being upset about stuff. And everyone's like, suck it up. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So you get this family response to it.
Yeah.
I'm you mentioned that you feel strong family commitments. And it's kind of envious. My family wasn't very hive-like. We just kind of all went and did our things, you know. So we were very, and you know, and I think it was part of assimilation for my dad. He wanted us to integrate into, you know, U.S. culture, and he was a child of immigrants and all that. So there's a lot of things affecting this, but yeah, that's a good way to get us going. Is that families can be more or less hive-y, right? And the family that meets every year with 100 people at the coast, that's pretty hive-y. Does anybody have a more hive-y family than that? That's pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, you feel it. And you also feel it in family reunions because you look like some of the people you're with. That's another way that it's about suppressing individuality, which normally we think of as a bad thing, right? We're in a very individualistic culture. Other examples in your personal experience? And, I mean, it's as simple as getting a group of people to wear the same T-shirt, right? And it can be that mundane. We talked about we didn't mention icebreakers. Consoling behaviors are part of our hive mentality. How easy is it for you to, among your peers, to, you know, touch as a means of consolation? Touch is huge for oxytocin release. You know, saying, I'm very concerned about you is very different from, or good luck, you know, is very different from, oh, you know. I mean, Franz de Waal was showing lots of video of primates consoling each other, and I just felt like, wow. That's good. That's great. Maybe that's something we shouldn't lose, right? But it's also controversial, right? You know, we're very individualistic. We've got a lot of personal space. You don't want to be. There's a lot of people I don't want to get a consoling touch from. Yeah. So yeah.
Could you argue that kind of like that idea of like personal space is very Western, right?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Because as we become more individualistic, we you want more like this is our area that we don't want anybody encroaching on.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, you know this from social psychology. I mean, you can measure the distance that people are comfortable at in different cultures. When I go to Italy, everybody gets real close to me, and it's like, oh, that feels a little weird. Okay, we're in Italy. Communal experiences on that topic, you know, the passeggiata is a very common experience for Latin cultures, you know, where people between like 4 and 7:30, they're going to just get out in the street and walk around, and we're going to do it again tomorrow. And it's like, what's the point of that? We could be getting something productive done. You know, that's kind of the American, like, why are these people all walking around before dinner? Why don't they just eat? You know, you go to, as an American, you go to Europe, and you're like, let's eat at 5:30. Anyway, the passeggiata is a kind of simple hive behavior that a more individualistic car culture doesn't retain. Yeah.
We also were kind of talking about how basically anything that you might jokingly or non-jokingly qualify as like a cult should kind of be considered as
a
hive. So.
Yeah, that's the danger side of hive. Yeah, we could add cults on our danger list, right?
Yeah.
Our hive danger list.
And I mean, like, that term is used jokingly. Like, I was in a dorm, and non-jokingly,
right.
You know,
right.
There's serious cults, which
right.
can be kind of scary.
Yeah.
But then there's, like, I don't know, people
yeah.
qualify Marian as a cult because we just never lived before. But
yeah, absolutely. No, and when you're in a social, you can sort of feel like you're part of a cult, maybe. Yeah, you joke about it. Yeah. Good. Others? Yeah. So experiences in our lives, that feeling of being connected at a party, feeling it's a kind of, you relax, you let down your guard. You feel like you're really So again, that's another part of the mechanism that involves loss of individuality, which we kind of have some red flags about, right? Because we're very concerned about people maintaining their individuality. When you think about the value of the hive, it gets the elephants talking, right? So the key thing here is that the suppression of critical judgment is essential to getting the elephants to talk. And I don't mean talking literally, obviously. I mean, you're dancing with people. You change your relationship. How many of you have been to a concert with some people and had that kind of connection, and it overrode maybe some less than ideal chemistry? Like you say, wow, I feel closer to this person than I would otherwise have felt. Right? I'm getting some nods on that? Okay. So the suppression of critical judgment is essential. And as philosophers, you're all supposed to be against anything that suppresses critical judgment. But that depends on assumes that there isn't sometimes a trade-off between suppressing critical judgments and getting together with people and being a group. Remember, behind this discussion is the idea that maybe we will flourish better if we can act as a group. And that's in tension with a lot of things in individualistic culture, which say maybe we'll flourish better if we just motivate everybody individually to pursue their self-interest by maximizing their rewards in the labor market, right? That's a huge part of our ideology. I don't reject that fundamentally, but notice that it works against the hive. It keeps you from dancing on the weekends.
That kind of made me think about political rallies, because there's like, a hive mentality.
Absolutely.
But also, like, you get so caught up in what the speaker is saying that I feel like people don't question what they're like advocating that much, like especially with like political candidates and stuff like that. They might just like say things and everyone will cheer, and then like, but not really think about why they're cheering necessarily.
You cheer, you chant, you repeat slogans, you say things that are off extreme, maybe, I think, or maybe you do, You bring signs, you may wear similar clothes, right? At the Women's March, it was a lot of people wearing a certain kind of cap, that they've maybe made. Yeah, so you do things, you wear t-shirts together. Is your feeling like that might take away from the intelligence of the movement? Or do you see that as a necessary part of motivating people to move together?
Think both.
So you're not willing to throw out the hive. I'm going to mix my metaphors. Throw out the hive with the bathwater, maybe baby with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's what I'm getting at with this critical question. Is the value of the hive something that we're not really capitalizing on, appreciating? Have we gone too far in suppressing hive culture? That's a great question for your notes. That's kind of what your small groups were about. Have we gone too far in suppressing hive culture? What do you think?
I thought about the example of elderly care and how nowadays it's in a less hive or less traditional culture, it's more common to put our elderly in homes as opposed to keeping them like in our homes.
Right.
And maybe that's because like people like the care is maybe couldn't, but like I think it's just more common now.
Yeah, a lot of my Italian friends talk about how wonderful it is that the Americans don't feel obligated to live in multi-generational households. I'm kind of a little envious. I don't think I would want it, frankly. I'm an American, but I don't think I'd want to like raise my family with my in-laws upstairs and my parents in the basement and my cousin out in the back or something. But that's not such an unusual arrangement for Italians, and they have mixed feelings about it. They look at the American model and they see it as having a little more freedom. So I'm not trying to paint a single picture here. I just want you to kind of engage in a little critical discussion about what would you say is distinctive, positively or negatively, about the way we, say you guys in your music culture, experience the hive. How many of you have been to a concert that involves staying overnight? Do you guys do this much? Maybe you don't do it that much. They got really expensive, didn't they? And you had to buy, like, all the days. In the old days, you could buy, like, one day of Sasquatch. But now, am I right? Most of the concerts, you have to buy, like, the whole thing. Those are... The thing that strikes me is, in comparison, say, to an Italian communal eating festival, is that this is an individual choice based on your tastes. The communal eating festival, you're going to go and you're going to have the... whatever the communal food is. Maybe it's the celebration of the wild boar or
a certain kind of vegetable or, you know, meat. And you're going to eat together with people on long tables. In the Sasquatch or Coachella model, you're going to get together with your group, and maybe you'll camp together, right? So think about the way our hive experiences are qualified by individual choice, right? I don't know if I'd want to be thrown together in a camping group at a concert with people I didn't choose, right? But you might be comfortable dancing with them, you know, while the music's playing, right? Okay, anything else? We're getting close to a good treatment. So what types of hive experiences, if you do see a value to the hive, what types of, one value it might have, by the way, would be addressing polarization in the country. We're really polarized, as you all know, politically. Some people suggest things like national service as a way of doing that. I'm not sure I'd advocate that. You know, I think I would have been annoyed if somebody wanted to delay my career for 2 years while I did mandatory national service. Am I right? Is that where a lot of you are? Right? But in a lot of cultures, it's still quite accepted that you're going to do some civil service. Many people think Mormons have a really good idea in continuing to require missionary service of their adult members. Anybody experience the hive at Bloomsday? Kind of a nice way. That's something that's within reach for American culture. Because notice, everybody individually chooses to go, and you can kind of stay in your space, but you're also kind of experiencing that effervescence of being with 30,000, 40,000 people. Also, I think, you know, one thing Americans do pretty well hive-wise is parades and 4th of July. With religious community, the only point I would make is that religious communities, we're going to talk about religion as a team sport next time. It's a really interesting way to wrap up our course, especially with you guys. Religious communities are a real source of hive bonding, and it's especially interesting to me when religious communities don't just help their own, right? So part of the one thing that religious communities do is they help their own, right? And that's great. That's part of how you maintain a bond. More and more, religious communities deliver social services and help to people regardless of their affiliation, right? So in the old days, it would have been more typical to expect a Christian social organization to be focused on Christians. And you still see this in, like, Union Gospel Mission, right? You don't get to stay at Union. I know someone who stayed at Union Gospel Mission. You don't get to stay there without hearing the pitch, you know, to take Christ in your life. Whereas it's an interesting trend that religious communities today don't do that as much. And that would be an example of a positive use of the hive. You leverage kind of the unity of the religious group, but you avoid, remember we were talking about the Dutch men on oxytocin, you avoid, which you'll never, I hope you'll never forget about the Dutch men on oxytocin, but you avoid the out-group, the negative out-group, you undermine the negative out-group effect by directing your services to outgroups. So it becomes less about Christians versus Muslims and more about how religious communities benefit the community at large. Okay, any other last-minute thoughts? I think we're pretty good here. Corporations are hives. Watch out for them. Okay. Yeah, good. Okay, great. Thanks. Let's break.